I began to worry as the plane landed. I became alarmed when the flight attendant prepared by putting on a coat, a large scarf, and gloves. I'd hoped for a few more minutes of warmth. I was landing in the Arctic Circle in northern Sweden. I was to stay in one of the most incredible structures in the world, a hotel made completely from ice. My wife had picked up the New York Times travel section a year ago and read about this ice hotel. She learned how every year they build a 60-room hotel from 3,000 tons of snow and ice. She decided then and there that she had to visit it. Earlier that day at breakfast in Stockholm, I asked her why exactly we were going to the ice hotel. She got as close as she ever does to philosophical, for she is first and foremost a woman of action.
I want to taste everything. I want to try it. I want to sample. I want to do this really neat thing. And I've never been to Sweden, and it's a great excuse to come to Sweden and hang out in the Arctic Circle. And and I've experienced the Arctic Circle in summer, but never in winter. I wanted to try out 30 below and see what that was like.
What specifically, I ask, excited her about the experience of the ice hotel?
Because it's cool, because it's beautiful, because it's ephemeral, because they build it new every year and it melts back to the river, and that's just amazing. You build ice sculptures inside, and every year it's unique.
Her very physical way of experiencing the world is not mine. She travels around the world to climb rocks or backpack along a glacier, while I prefer words. Reading to me is the supreme experience. I agree completely with the Argentinian writer Borges. I think of reading a book, he wrote, as no less an experience than traveling or falling in love. I think that reading Barclay or Shaw or Emerson, these are quite as real experiences to me as seeing London. So that day, as we flew from Stockholm to the Arctic, I buried myself in a book about traveling through the Sahara Desert. I was in denial about going to the Arctic. I had only briefly formed an image of where we were going and what it would be like. It occurred when my wife and I were packing for this trip. As we laid out our things, she pointed to a set of warm clothes and said, "We should carry them on rather than check them. They're mission critical." I don't like vacations where anything in my luggage is described as mission critical. As we approached the airport, the pilot told us it was minus 29 degrees Celsius outside. That's 52 degrees Fahrenheit below freezing. As the plane neared the ground, I began to think of those mission-critical warm clothes in our carry-on luggage.
For safety reasons, we ask you to keep your seat belt fastened.
On landing, I hope for a few more minutes of warmth, but there is no jetway. So we exit the plane by a set of stairs and walk across the tarmac in the frigid weather. We'd scheduled transport from the airport to the ice hotel by dog sled, but instead got a rude awakening about exactly how cold it was. We met a representative of the ice hotel who explains why our dog sled ride has been canceled.
Too cold for the dogs, not for you, but for the dogs. Because they get so much cold air inside, it's not good for.
Too cold for the dogs, but not for me. I don't like this at all. Instead of a dog sled, we take a bus to the ice hotel. As we leave the airport, my friend Alan, we are traveling with Alan and his wife Pat, points out how far north we've flown. He notes that it is high noon, but the sun sits only 5 degrees above the horizon. Next, he draws my attention to the satellite dishes along the road. They point, he notes, toward the horizon so they can reach satellites that circle the equator half a globe away. After that, we all sit quietly and study the snow-covered landscape. I find myself wondering what my stay in the ice hotel will be like. Will it be anything like the first ice palace? It was built by a Russian princess and was a monstrous joke. The cruel Russian Empress Anna, niece of Peter the Great, had built the first ice hotel in 1740 to punish a member of the Russian nobility. Prince Mikhail angered her by converting to Catholicism, so she punished him by forcing him to sit on a basket of eggs and cackle until they hatched. Not satisfied with this, she made the prince marry one of her servants, a woman described as of exceptional ugliness. She'd been nicknamed Brushinia after the empress's favorite dish of roast pork with spiced vinegar and onion sauce. Even this forced marriage wasn't enough punishment. Immediately after the ceremony, she forced the bride and groom, festooned in furs, to sit in an iron cage on top of an elephant. They led a parade of hundreds of provincial couples, Lapps, Finns, and others, all dressed in their national costumes. They marched to an ice palace. On the Neva River, she'd commissioned an architect to build a palace of ice for the couple's wedding night. In this ice palace, she had armed guards force them to stay all night in an ice bed. In spite of its cruel purpose, the palace itself was a true work of art. Built of exceptionally clear ice from the River Neva, the palace was 56 feet tall, 17 feet wide, and over 21 feet long. To build it, the architect had precisely measured with a compass and ruler each block, carefully cut them, then used a crane to set them exactly in place. Freezing water joined the blocks so smoothly that they appeared to be one single piece. A visitor said of the ice palace that it was infinitely more beautiful than if it had been constructed of the finest marble. The transparency and bluish tone of the ice gave it the look of some precious stone. Every detail in the palace showed exquisite craftsmanship. 29 ice trees adorned the building. Flora and fauna were sculpted from ice and then painted natural colors. And while most of the palace was left transparent, the pillars, doors, and window frames were painted green to simulate marble. The window panes were made from the thinnest ice possible. So as our bus tooled along a snow-covered Arctic highway, I prepared for an experience of beauty and discomfort. Our bus arrives at the ice hotel, but we cannot see it. We must wait for a tour, plus we need to get outfitted to battle the cold weather. As we leave the bus to dash into the warm reception hall, my friend Alan draws our attention.
There's a thermometer hanging here in Celsius, reading minus 25 and a half.
Again, minus 25 and a half Celsius is some 46 degrees Fahrenheit below freezing. I'm not pleased to learn this, but I've brought with me high-tech clothes especially designed for cold weather. Most of them were an engagement gift years ago from my wife, which I now realize should have been my first clue that I'd end up in the Arctic. They're made from synthetic material that wicks water away from my body. In cold weather, this is crucial because the problem isn't getting warm, it's staying warm. As your body heats itself, it sweats. And if you wear cotton or wool, the water produced stays near your skin and pulls out the heat. So at the ice hotel reception area, I put on no less than 6 layers of clothing, then cover it with a huge insulated coverall suit supplied by the ice hotel. I put earmuffs on, then a hat, then I cover this with what I used to call a face mask, but my wife says I must now call a balaclava. Apparently, the first people to wear full face masks were the soldiers of the Crimean village of Balaclava. They popularized this headgear in ferocious battles of the Crimean War. Still, in some subconscious denial about the Arctic, I keep calling it a baklava, a food I note from Greece, a very warm country. When we finish suiting up, it's time for our ice hotel orientation tour. It begins with an ominous warning.
We have this check-in tour because this is not a normal hotel. And to be able to survive the night and enjoy your stay here, we have to teach you how to live here. And tonight it's very cold, it's minus 30 degrees, and it's actually a bit dangerously cold, so you have to beware.
With that, we are allowed to enter the ice hotel. In our 7 layers of clothing, and with the temperature dropping now to nearly 72 degrees below freezing, we thread our way along a path lined by giant ice obelisks, each 8 feet tall and 3 feet square. As my wife notes, they're the same shape and size as a porta potty. We can see the ice hotel in front of us. It's a 1-story building nearly 100 feet wide. On this trail, we pass a refrigerated Thermo King truck. It is unloading into the ice hotel skids of Absolut vodka, citron, lemon, and currant flavored. I take this as a positive sign of civilization until I realize that the Thermo King truck is needed to keep the vodka from freezing. Ever enthusiastic, Alan is, of course, at the door first.
The front entrance is built of clear blocks of ice with reindeer skin doors.
Alan, Pat, my wife, and I take a breath, and then Alan pulls on the reindeer antler door handles and we enter the ice hotel. The first thing we sense is warmth. The temperature inside the ice hotel is 20 degrees below freezing, but compared to the outside, this feels toasty. Then we notice quiet. Inside the ice hotel, all sound dies in the 3 feet thick snow and ice walls. The only sound is our own footsteps. We enter the great hallway. A mist rises from its floor. Its roof made of great arches 30 feet tall, held up by massive pillars carved from sparkling clear ice. I feel a sense of contradiction. The walls are made of snow and ice, so they seem fragile, yet at the same time massive. The supports are transparent, yet solid. There are no vertical walls. Everything is part of an arch. This drives my eye to focus on the top, where an arch culminates in a point. This point tells me that these aren't the semicircular arches of Roman or Byzantine architecture, but influenced by Gothic design. The arches look like they've been transplanted from a giant cathedral and then frosted with translucent snow and ice. Next, we set out to search for our rooms. From the great hallway, we venture down a smaller corridor, perhaps 15 feet tall, made of arches shaped like those of the great hallway. The guest rooms line this corridor. The doors of the rooms are just holes cut into the ice walls, then covered with a flimsy curtain. Next to these doors, the room number is carved in snow. We locate our rooms and enter them.
Oh, look at the chocolates, frozen solid.
The carpet is made of snow.
I've never had a bed that was lit from underneath before. This is going to be...
Are those candles under?
I don't know. Let's see.
It's a fluorescent light.
So instead of legs for the bed, there's blocks of ice, and then it looks like a wood frame.
What is it?
It's a foam mattress, and then reindeer skins.
Alan sums it up the best.
I see a block of ice. I see reindeer skins on it. There are no reindeer pillows. And there's a nightstand made of ice to put my glasses on so that they stick to my face when I wake up.
From there, we explore the rest of the ice hotel. We find intricate sculptures carved out of ice. In one room, a Viking ship juts out of the wall. In another, an Egyptian pyramid rules the floor. And oddly, in a corner, there's a life-size statue of Frank Zappa sitting on a toilet. Next, we come across the room, which to me is the crowning glory of the ice hotel, the absolute vodka bar. To enter the bar, we pass through a 30-foot-tall ice wall where they've cut an opening the shape of a vodka bottle. The room is like a huge igloo, its dome reaching 50 feet in the air. The room is filled with tables and benches carved from 4-inch-thick ice. The bar itself is one huge chunk of ice. I immediately order a drink called a Northern Light. Alan orders a fire and ice. Ironically, his breath condenses as he says fire. Our drinks are served on the rocks in the most literal sense. Our glasses are a chunk of ice with a hole in it. Our bartender explains.
We have a special drill, a machine that makes them. You drill a hole, you cut them in squares, you dip them quickly in hot water and let them freeze again. And while you dip them in hot water, it's just that you have to get the sawdust out of the bottle of the...
We are comfortable at the bar, but are reminded our comfort is only relative to the outside when we notice that the stereo is in a refrigerator to keep it warm. We also see our bartender dipping her pen into the flame of a candle.
I have to warm up the ink, otherwise I can't write anything with it. It looks very silly. And the worst thing is when you're standing at this and you look around and then you look at the pen and it's on fire.
Following our drinks in the ice bar, we tour the hotel studying the sculptures until it's time to spend the night in the ice hotel. Staying in the hotel is much less exciting than you'd think. First, attached to the ice hotel was a real heated building. It contained a changing room and heated toilets, non-ice toilets, I note. Second, they gave us special sleeping bags rated for 20 degrees cooler than the actual temperature of the ice hotel. Our guide told us that wearing anything more than the lightest of clothes would make us sweat, and that sweat would suck the warmth from our bodies, making us very cold at night. So we change into light clothing in the heated changing room, then dash to our beds to crawl into our sleeping bags. None of us emerge from our warm cocoons until morning, when an ice hotel hostess comes by to offer us warm lingonberry juice. We then gather in the changing room, where I chat with other guests about how well they spent the night.
Very well. Woke up once, I think. I was out like a light.
Terrible, really. Main problem was the sleeping bag. Kept getting tied in knots and twisted and turning all night, and you got to untangle yourself. But other than that, I weren't cold or nothing. It was quite fine. But
although he did have one problem.
Dropped my pillow, and it went onto the floor, and I picked it up, and it was freezing. Freezing.
Next, I check with Alan and Pat.
Going to the bathroom scared me back to sleep. Just the idea of having to put on all those clothes.
My nose got cold at one point, and that woke me up, so it took a little while to convince myself I really wanted to stay inside the sleeping bag and not go anywhere.
There was the time that I was lying there, and I gave a great big exhale lying on my back, and it snowed back on top of me.
and my wife rated the experience highly.
It was great. I got up once, braved the elements to go to the bathroom, came back. Which is, it's actually better than being camping, because you know, when you get out of your nice, toasty, warm sleeping bag, you don't have to go into the cold and dark and dig a hole. You can go to a nice, proper restroom with heating and lights and radio, and much, much easier than being camping.
You can see one of the problems my wife and I have in choosing where to travel. I never rate the comfort of a hotel by how far it was above digging a hole for going to the bathroom. I was eager after my night in the hotel to find out why anyone would build such a beautiful yet ephemeral thing. I mentioned to my wife and our friends that I'm going to find the architect of the ice hotel and talk to him or her, but they insist that I first have some Arctic experiences. We took a dog sled ride along the ice over Torna River. We rode in that long twilight characteristic of the Arctic. Even though 50 degrees below freezing quickly numbs fingers, toes, and noses, the twilight made up for it by making the snow look luminous and blue. We visited with some Sami, the indigenous people of northern Sweden. They coached us in driving a reindeer sleigh and shared their amazing knowledge of reindeer.
It's hard to sound like it, but like this.
And as I held on tightly, my wife drove a snowmobile into a dark forest, and we sat in the freezing cold until the northern lights appeared above us. We watched them flicker and twist until they disappeared. And of course, the snowmobile was too tame for my experience-loving, rock-climbing, primitive camping wife. She just wanted to
just let it out, but we never really got any straightaways. I really wanted to see what that thing could do.
And not all experiences were as sublime as visiting natives or taking in the great cosmic display of light. Some were more mundane, yet to my wife, equally important.
I found out that the giant monolithic pieces of ice that look like porta potties, they're outside, so if you lick them, your tongue will stick to them.
After enough experience for me, I left Pat, Alan, and my wife. They planned to take another snowmobile ride and let them out. I wanted to find out why anyone would build something as beautiful yet temporal as the Ice Hotel. I'm used to buildings, art, or literature that's made to last the centuries. So the Ice Hotel puzzled me. In the morning, I tracked down the architect of the Ice Hotel, a man named Aki Lawson. When we meet, I first notice Lawson's hat. It's a knit skullcap that makes him look like a medieval deacon. I expect when I glance down to see him wearing vestments, but he wears only a thin cloth jacket. He chain smokes as we chat in his barely heated office, which is scattered with papers and drawings. How, I ask, did he get started working with ice?
I've been working with wood 20 years before I turned over to ice. I started with furniture when I needed furniture. I didn't want to buy what was out in the shops. So I started to make my own furniture. And then it turns over to be more and more artistic furniture. And suddenly I realized that there were no furniture anymore. It was just art.
Once he realized he was making art, Lawson sought out other media. He made sculptures of ice and fell in love with the medium. Over time, he refined his methods for building ice sculptures and then moved on to bigger things. I asked him what exactly the magnificent translucent arches of the Ice Hotel were made from.
I call these materials snice. The density is just between snow and ice.
He explains that to make the arches, they use snow cannons to blast this special snice mixture into a mold. This compacts the snow tightly so that when the temperature reaches 50 degrees below freezing, the snice becomes a mass so solid that Lawson tells me you could drive a car on the roof. Yet these arches that make up the ice hotel aren't permanent, like his wood furniture. In fact, they don't even keep their shape over the season.
One of the things with the snow construction is it compresses all the time. The whole building shrinks. The building is 5.5 meter high, the highest arch. In the end of the season, it's 4.5, so it goes down 1 meter.
What inspires him to create these transient arches made of snice instead of something permanent and enduring?
Yes, I spend the summers around Europe to look at old cathedrals.
And which cathedrals inspire him the most?
In Reims, in France. Very beautiful arches. And also St. Peter's in Rome. St. Peter's for the size.
Again, I ask him why ice? Why not stone or wood?
It's to realize a dream, a fairy tale, to build a castle in snow and ice. That's the goal for me, to build up a dream. It's just for the moment. Enjoy the moment, the day you are in. Don't think about the future or the last. Just here and now, and enjoy it.
And what does he dream of building in ice, of building for the moment?
St. Peter's. And it's possible to do. The sky is the limit here.
How does he feel about his ice cathedral disappearing at the end of every winter?
Happy, because then I start to draw a new one.
Still, I wondered why anyone would create something so intricate and beautiful yet short-lived. I returned to the ice hotel to search for the answer. I found an artist working on a huge ice statue of a woman.
A lady of the river. Yeah, it's a very big lady. The mother of the river.
The statue is very detailed and has obviously taken days to carve, yet it will be gone in a few months. So I ask, why does he like working in ice?
Yeah, it's perfect. Nobody can buy it. The water takes your life back. And yeah, it's perfect for me.
I realize now that the Ice Hotel reminds us of how we should approach art and even life. The novelist Walker Percy captured the essence of this approach with a single question about the Grand Canyon. He asks, is it really possible today to experience the Grand Canyon? It seems an odd, almost nonsensical question, but Percy was after something very deep when he talked of experience. When the first Spanish explorer stumbled unexpectedly on the Grand Canyon, he experienced wonder and delight as he took in its depths, patterns, colors, and shadows. Today, our experience starts with a travel brochure and a distinct image of the Grand Canyon. When we arrive, we ask ourselves, does it look like a postcard? If so, we go home and say it's every bit as beautiful as a postcard. If it doesn't conform to our expectations, maybe the colors are somber or the day is cloudy, any disparity between the experience and the postcard makes us return home saying, I was unlucky. I wasn't there at the right time. Percy argues that the only way to truly experience the Grand Canyon is to stumble upon it. That's what, in a sense, the Ice Hotel does. It makes us stumble on it because every year it's new. It reminds us that when we approach any creative work, a piece of art, literature, a building, or even the most ordinary everyday object, to truly appreciate it, we must remove our blinders and see it fresh, unmediated by any preconceptions.
Hey, Langolo, 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 Langolo bohopet oppgir. Høylandgalor.